This week on the Writer's Detective Bureau, career-long fitness, amateur sleuths, and the future of policing. I'm Adam Richardson, and this is the Writer's Detective Bureau. Welcome to episode 59 of the Writer's Detective Bureau, the podcast dedicated to helping authors and screenwriters write professional quality crime-related fiction. And this week, I'm answering your questions about whether police departments require routine physical fitness testing, how an amateur sleuth could plausibly team with a police detective, and what I think the future of police work looks like. But before I go any further, I need to give my shout-outs to my Gold Shield patrons, Deborah Dunbar from deborahdunbar.com, CeCe Jamison from ccjamison.com, Larry Keaton, Vicky Tharp of vickytharp.com, Dharma Kelleher of dharmakelleher.com, Chris Ann, Jimmy Coe of CrimmyBox, and Larry Darter for their support. And a huge thanks to the Coffee Club patrons for their support as well. You can probably hear in my voice that this has been a very long work week for me, and the coffees that you bought me definitely carried me through. You can find links to everyone supporting this episode in the show notes at writersdetective.com/59. And to learn about setting up your own Patreon account for your author business, visit writersdetective.com/Patreon, P-A-T-R-E-O-N. Brian Richards, who you can find on Instagram at BRichWrites, sent in this week's first question. Brian writes, I've been listening to your podcast since you were interviewed by Joanna Penn. Thank you for all you do in helping aspiring writers. A few episodes back, you talked about physical agility tests that new police candidates have to take to graduate from the academy and then to join a police department. The detective in my work in progress is up there in age. Would he have to take any periodic physical agility tests to demonstrate that he can still do the job? What about any other regular testing, like shooting? Thanks. Well, I'm glad you found me, Brian. Yeah, Joanna Penn is awesome, and I was very lucky to be on her podcast. So to get to your question about routine physical agility testing, that really depends upon the agency. And sadly, most agencies don't require them. There are a lot that do, but the overwhelming majority do not. And I think a lot of that has to do, honestly, with being short-sighted. Agencies don't want to pay for cops to work out on duty like firefighters, nor do they want the workers' compensation claims that happen if they get injured while working out. They want us out there on the street doing the job that they pay us for and not sitting around a firehouse. Not sitting around a police station, lifting weights, playing volleyball, or playing basketball. They actually want us out there working, and we definitely get criticized for wasting taxpayer dollars otherwise. Now, that's not sarcasm. You hear my voice. That's jealousy of my fire brothers and sisters. I clearly picked the wrong public service branch. I'm only kidding. So basically, most police agencies have decided that they don't want to pay cops to stay in shape. And I'm sure many of you are thinking, why should they have to pay for you to work out? But the reality is, if you are testing for it, it is a job performance requirement. So it's part of your job, which means the department would have to pay for them to do it and incur the liability when injuries happen. Now, the younger generation of cops, especially in the current Insta, selfie, look at me era, are definitely staying in great shape by working out away from work. But after decades of high stress, long shifts, emotional trauma, physical trauma, poor food options at 3 o'clock in the morning, many of us do not prioritize our physical or mental health like we should. As for other testing, we do have regular job-related trainings that are state-mandated, and we do have regular firearms qualifications. Where I work, we qualify with our firearms quarterly. A lot of larger agencies may qualify only once a year. If your character's on the SWAT team, they would definitely qualify a lot more often than once a year. But as I just mentioned, at least in California, our training is state mandated, and certain things like perishable skills, and I'm talking things like arrest and control techniques, first aid, CPR, using an AED, emergency vehicle operations, which we abbreviate as EVOC, which it covers both slow speed precision driving, like parallel parking that big old Crown Victoria, and driving through like a tight slalom course of cones. And it also includes the fun stuff like collision avoidance, skid control, pursuit driving, applying the pursuit intervention technique or PIT. Those are all perishable skills, meaning those skills diminish over time if you aren't continuing to train or use those techniques. So we train in those perishable skills every 24 months, and that's something that's been required or mandated by the state. And that means that once a quarter, we spend an 8-hour day doing training. Some of our training, like the legal update stuff or the workplace anti-harassment training that most people in the corporate world have to go through, that stuff's done on the computer. But so much of our work involves physically doing something that the majority of what our training unit has us do involves hands-on training. And I should mention that every agency usually has someone responsible for handling the training requirements for the agency and maintaining records of everyone's training. Any decent-sized agency will have a dedicated training unit, and some really small agencies may have one or two people assigned to present the training to the department, and that training person may also serve as the rangemaster on firearms qualification day. And lastly, these training officers, whether they're in a training unit with a bunch of other training officers or just somebody who has this as a collateral duty to their regular patrol job in a small agency, they're often sent to a train-the-trainer school for whatever discipline they are about to teach. So they learn how to teach these classes to other officers. And the other alternative that agencies have, they still will have some sort of training coordinator for the agency, but they may outsource the actual teaching. So the officers may go to another agency's training class or to a regional training center or a regional police academy to meet those state mandated training requirements. And to anticipate one of your follow-up questions, I don't know if Brian would ask this or if you're thinking it right now, I know that FBI agents are given on-duty time to hit the gym, and they have yearly physical fitness testing, which always makes me think of Gary Busey retrieving a brick from the bottom of the pool in Point Break. So thanks for the question, Brian. Again, you can find Brian on Instagram at BRichWrites. This week's next question comes from Lisa Leone, who you can find at lisaleone.com. Lisa writes, "Hi, Adam. I write cozy mysteries and find it tricky to balance law enforcement expectations and relationships with amateur sleuths in a believable yet fiction-friendly way. In the manuscript I'm revising, the sleuth's brother is a detective. I'd like there to be a good relationship between them in terms of the information sharing. For example, he recognizes she may be able to get people to talk sometimes when he wouldn't be able to since she's not with law enforcement. Could you talk about how detectives and amateur sleuths may share information, especially if they're related? Also, could you talk about the areas where it may work best to fudge reality a bit for the sake of story? Thanks for your insight." Thanks for the question, Lisa. Yes, it is tough to balance that in a cozy because in real life, there isn't a balance. It is absolutely one-sided. The detective will take and take and take and not give back to the amateur sleuth because those are the rules, whether they're brother and sister or not. So the information is definitely going to be a one-way street. And if your amateur sleuth understands that and is doing her thing for the greater good of the case, meaning she doesn't have to know what her brother knows, then the relationship as far as how they're going to work off of one another might actually be okay. But if the sibling thing heats up because of that one-way information flow, well, at least you'll have some believable conflict between the characters, which is good as it can lead to her to branch out on her own, albeit putting her in jeopardy of interfering with the police investigation. But conflict always drives story. For the detective brother to use the amateur sleuth sister to get people to talk, that can get a little dicey from a legal perspective, as he'd essentially be using her like an informant, which is totally plausible, but it comes along with the rules of using an informant. She is essentially working as an agent for the police department if she does that. So definitely listen to last episode, which was episode 58, where I talk about confidential informants. As for fudging reality, That would be if the brother's passing information back to the sister, especially as she's an amateur sleuth, which really means she has no legal standing or reason to receive that information at all. Treating her as a confidential informant might be the most realistic way to accomplish this. So I guess they're technically working on it together, but you're really putting her in harm's way, potentially, and making her a reliable informant. That CRI status I talked about in the last episode will definitely take some effort. But I think with any fan of the cozy genre, they understand that, you know, this is a cozy. And so you can have that brotherly, sisterly flow of information because that level of trust is there. So I would certainly explore that. Never let reality get in the way of a good story. And those are the kind of things that, and we talk about tropes a lot on this podcast, but those are the kind of things where you can see that happening. And you're going to be okay with fudging reality in that way. So maybe he gives it to her on the QT, or they have this working understanding that, you know, she's not allowed to say anything, but she needs to be in the know. Or you can save that, you know, back and forth for having there be some conflict, which then pushes her out to do something on her own without her brother in her back pocket. So I hope this helps, Lisa. And again, you can find Lisa at lisaleone.com. Author Coralie Tate of CoralieTate.com asked, how do you envision policing being different in Los Angeles in 10 or 15 years? Do technological advancements change much about the job? Or is people being people the overwhelming paradigm? If you don't see it changing much in the near future, what would it take to really shift things? Oof, those are tough questions. For starters, law enforcement is never an early adopter of technology. We are usually last due to two things. Number one is budget, and number two is the court system, or at least the court system and the lawyer's ability to accept advances in technology as fact, or at least as fact that we can rely upon. So while scientists have recently developed ways to analyze segments of DNA of twins to be able to determine which twin left their DNA at a crime scene, it will be decades before those methods and techniques will be proven as fact in a court of law, and that it is certain enough of a fact to be able to hang a person's fate upon. I definitely do not see flying patrol cars, in-field DNA scanning, or instant facial recognition via body-worn camera happening in the next 10 to 15 years. In fact, in the latter case, there are already laws against it. Facebook and Target can know everything about you, but not the cops trying to thwart crime. Now, I apologize in advance for the rant I'm about to go on, but I've been looking forward to answering this as I like to think myself a bit of a futurist. And in all honesty, I think policing in Los Angeles in 10 or 15 years is going to be dealing with some serious challenges as a result of what's starting to happen right now politically. There is going to be a shift, but it won't be as the result of technology. California politics and even national news media perpetuate the myth that cops are bad and only a few are good, like the good ones are the exceptions, and that we are assumed to be bad until we do something quote-unquote good. Because the quote-unquote good cops are the ones giving warnings instead of tickets, which, in other words, means they're not really doing their jobs. Not that anyone wants to get a ticket, but that's not what they're there for. Our governor just eliminated the Posse Comitatus Act in California. The New York Times covered the story with this headline: California allows public to refuse to help law enforcement. That was the title of the article on September 6th of this year, actually just a couple days ago. In reality, this bill did absolutely nothing from a legal perspective. Oh, so I can't arrest this bystander for refusing to help me arrest this serious felon that's fighting me and trying to take my gun? In reality, that doesn't happen anyway. I mean, everyone's standing around videoing us fighting for our lives. Just this week, there was a deputy that had her gun taken away from her, and they had people standing there videoing it, and he shot at her. So with this Posse Comitatus Act elimination, that was written by Senator Bob Hertzberg, Democrat, what did his bill actually do? It created news headlines that essentially said after 147 years of this law being on the books, we, the citizens of California, do not believe we have to support our cops. In the wake of the Ferguson, Missouri incident and the subsequent rioting, there have been numerous studies on what is called the Ferguson effect. Now, the Ferguson effect is the idea that an increased distrust of police has led to an increased crime or murder rate. And most of those studies draw the conclusion that there hasn't been a detectable effect. I think if this portrayal of cops as the bad guys, as not to be trusted, as being separate from our communities, or oppressors that need to be rallied against, then I think the biggest issue policing will be dealing with in 10 or 15 years will be the true measure of the Ferguson effect. Not just how the public distrusts cops, but the reaction by police to being painted with the broad brush of distrust. Why go look for an armed felon and try to save the day when that can lead to me getting shot or my shooting someone, justifiably, and then have that get me labeled a murderer or a racist or the poster boy for bad cops in the national media, all for trying to do the job none of those criticizers are willing to do? When I can simply stand here, take a report of what happened, and not make the effort to risk my life and reputation. Yeah, sorry you got away. I couldn't risk getting in a shooting because it's dark outside right now and I can't be absolutely sure that he's holding a gun. It probably is, but if I'm wrong, I'll be tried as a murderer. So no thanks. I'll just wait till he's gone and I'll go over there later and take the report. We'll just go to picking up the pieces whenever it's safe. And if for some reason I do catch the bad guy, he'll be out of jail before my paperwork is done. We've already emptied our prisons in California. Parolees, those that get let out of prison early, no longer face a one-year incarceration, which they call a bullet, in prison for violating parole in California. It's now a 10-day flash in county jail. They call it a flash instead of a bullet. That's some serious deterrence, isn't it? In that 10 whole days in jail, you can see the doctor, you can get that tooth abscess taken care of, you can get some food in you, and then you're back out on the street. We do not have a jail or prison overcrowding problem in this country. We have a problem with citizens not respecting the law. We have a violent crime problem. Scholars will look at a murder rate decline and a violent crime incline and associate those trends with some abstract intersection of socioeconomics and criminology, rather than realize that the only thing that changed is advances in emergency medicine. This stabbing or gunshot wound would have been fatal in 1999, but now that many of us carry individual first aid kits or IFACs that include combat tourniquets and occlusive dressings for sucking chest wounds, the chance of survival today is far improved. But it does not mean that we, as a people, are any less violent than before. We're just getting better at saving lives when it comes to the medicine. So in that regard, technology has advanced when it comes to emergency medicine out in the field, but it really does nothing other than skew the statistics to make us think that we're safer. But to continue answering the technology question you posed, Coralie, and speaking of futuristic Los Angeles, I have to quote Harrison Ford's character Rick Deckard in the movie Blade Runner. Now, hang on. I know my listeners are equal parts authors and screenwriters, so to quash the backlash before it starts, I'm well aware that Philip K. Dick's Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, upon which Blade Runner was adapted, was actually set in San Francisco. I know this because I too am a fan and I actually read it. So no hate mail, please. And now, back to my point. To quote Deckard, actually, I'll let Deckard tell you for himself.
Replicants are like any other machine. They're either a benefit or a hazard. They're a benefit, it's not my problem.
Tasers and even cell phones are perfect examples of beneficial technology for law enforcement becoming a problem. The taser shoots two electrodes and, after connecting with the suspect, uses electricity to immobilize the suspect. Unlike pain compliance tools like baton strikes or pepper spray or mace, the taser works whether the suspect feels pain or not. It physiologically locks up the muscles, and whether they can feel it or not, it allows officers to get the suspect restrained because they can't move. This device has saved countless lives of suspects who may have otherwise been shot. So how often does this benefit become a problem? Well, Officers have become too reliant on the taser. And when it fails, as all technology is apt to do, they have lost the only tool they really know how to use to take a resisting suspect into custody. Rely too heavily on the taser, and you won't be proficient in going hands-on, using those wrist locks and long arm bars. Those moves we practice, and what did I just say two questions ago about this, once every 2 years, because it's a perishable skill. And if you shirk that skill for the little electric cat toy on your belt every time, the taser has a red dot laser, then you're going to be in a world of hurt when your taser doesn't work and you're squaring off on some MMA fighter that doesn't want to get into handcuffs. And even worse than the reliance on the taser is the effect cell phones have had on our intrapersonal communication skills. When nearly an entire generation communicates solely by text message, looking someone square in the eye and having a confrontational dialogue is absolutely foreign to them. Even a non-confrontational conversation can feel uncomfortable, like talking to a victim or a witness giving a statement. It can be challenging to some of the kids becoming cops these days. So I think things are definitely shifting in ways that most people don't really think about. And this country is absolutely more divisive than ever. We argue with strangers online that we don't know under the veil of anonymity, and then we simply do not acknowledge anyone in real life that has opposing views. Our ability to agree to disagree has vanished in under a decade. This goes far beyond a policing problem, but the knee-jerk reactions made to these challenges always involve the police to enforce the politicians' plans, whether favorable or not. I can certainly see a day where California bans guns outright, and guess whose job it will be to go out and seize those guns? How many cops are going to be killed when that happens? I'm not saying I have any answers here, but I can certainly foresee the consequences down many of the different roads that our future holds. Which brings me to my own why. The reason why I do this podcast and the reason why I help writers, you, the writers of the world, are the only ones keeping alive the idea that the police are still the heroines and heroes in a crime story, that justice still prevails, that we have a system still worth fighting for because it still works. I fully admit that Chips and Adam 12 and Miami Vice had way too big of an impact on my childhood decision to want to become a cop. But think about that. Writers of fiction told story after story that cops are the good guys, the ones to turn to when you need help, because that's what they are there to do, to help. And that led to me and other kids to grow up to be police officers, to be police detectives. I didn't have cops in my family. So what you do is incredibly important. So I'm here to help you to keep that narrative alive. Because without that thin blue line of cops willing to help others, society as we know it will cease to exist because daily life will become the purge. So keep fighting the good fight. Keep writing your crime fiction stories because we need them now more than ever. Now, before we go, managing your passwords, and I mean secure passwords, shouldn't be like pulling teeth. I've been using LastPass as my password manager for years. It was actually the third password manager I tried, and it was by far the easiest to use and the most robust. It generates strong passwords for me, securely stores all of my passwords, my credit card info, and even notes I make to myself. This way, you only need to remember one password, and that's the one to get into LastPass. Getting started with LastPass is totally free, and upgrading to LastPass Premium, like I did, is just $3 a month, which allows you to sync your entire LastPass vault across all of your devices. I have it on my phone, tablet, laptop, desktop, and I can even access it through the website when I'm away from my devices. It's super fast and easy to log in to any website that you have a username and password saved for. If you're interested in checking out LastPass for free, or you can help keep the lights on in the bureau by upgrading to LastPass Premium for $3 a month, you can use my affiliate link by going to writersdetectivebureau.com/ LastPass. I only promote products I actually use and trust, and my affiliate links never add any additional cost to you. LastPass is the only password manager I use, and I've been using it for years, at least a dozen times a day. So go to writersdetectivebureau.com/LastPass to get your password situation totally squared away. Thank you so much for listening this week. Keep those questions coming. You can send me your crime fiction questions by going to writersdetective.com/podcast. Thanks again for listening. Have a great week and write well.